Okay,
well, let's see what's the plan, man. Okay. There's two of them, and they say the exact same spot, both sides, but I'm sorry, like I say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
Marlon,
are
you ready for this?
The cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc. UFOs over you,
and I am too surprised.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead. Doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Yes, these are Strange Days Indeed, and this program reflects the UFO side of this strangeness. Welcome to program number 382 in the current series. Tonight, for your listening pleasure, the pleasure of dining, listening, and dancing, Dave Ferlott, a UFO researcher and author, Nick Redfern, has just published his latest book, On the Trail of the Saucer Spies, an intriguing book. Will do nothing to chill out the paranoia level. It'll probably just ramp it up for a lot of people. Promises to be an interesting book, and Alfred Lemberg finally tonight will join us again and take us home.
Sure, and looking forward to throwing him a few curves.
Alfred Lemberg?
Yeah, always do. Here, try this one on, Alfred. What are you talking about?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what order it's going to happen in tonight. I had originally booked Nick for 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been trying the last couple of days to try and get a hold of him and say, look, we'd like to do it at 9:30.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what happens. Maybe Lemberg will have nothing to talk about at 9:30 tonight.
I can't imagine Alfred having nothing to talk about.
No. Actually, Alfred is a very interesting man. He's a former military. He's a chopper pilot.
Mm-hmm.
A career military man, finished his time in the military and got into teaching and down there in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And we know how, you know, broad-minded they are down there. And Alfred was using his website that's called Alien View to illustrate art and mm-hmm. interesting things. And apparently the school board were not impressed with that and suggested he take his tushy elsewhere.
As school boards would do.
As school
UFOs.
Boards would do, well, especially in broad-minded states like Alabama. That's what you get, you know.
Why is a 2x4, I guess. You walk that plank, buddy.
Yeah. Y'all come back now, you hear? Yeah, but not in this lifetime.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's our lineup for tonight. For the next couple of moments, I don't know. It's not a lot of UFO-related news this past week.
Not a whole lot of news, but I did find something.
Yes.
That I think any novices out there who have, you know, just tuning in for the first time,
mm-hmm.
who have been listening over the last little while and say, you know, where can I get some sort of general information about this crazy topic?
The library.
Yes. Yeah, no, don't go to the library. Don't do that. You'll find a whole lot of bunch of bad-smelling books.
Yeah, a lot of mostly the skeptical books.
Yeah.
All the good books have been stolen.
Well, they smell bad, so you don't want to touch them.
Yeah.
I found a really interesting site. If you're sitting by the computer, if you want to write this down. And it really encapsulates a lot of different things, not just about UFOs, the phenomenon itself, mm-hmm. but a lot of other different things. In regarding, I guess,
paranormal
kinds of things.
Ancient archaeology,
yeah,
that kind
definitely,
of stuff.
Definitely, yeah. And it's www.space/, not slash, but like a dash,
yeah.
And then 2001.net. That's www.space.
We don't need the www.
Whatever.
Yeah.
And then space, hyphen,
yes.
2001.net. And it's an interesting site. You can get a large amount of material, and you can get some very good overviews of the topics.
It's not hard to remember space, hyphen or dash 2001.
.net? No.
.net?
No, just give it a try and see.
Yeah. All the folks in Montreal who are listening right now because there's a hockey game on. It sounds good. Don't go.
Let me go there. There you go.
I like the sound effects. Thank you, Drew.
Here with his take on it is Dave Furloff.
I tend to be a student of human behavior and make a habit of observing people and their reactions to various stimuli. And based on this, I've developed a theory about debunkers of the UFO phenomenon. Now, please note, I said debunkers, not skeptics. Skeptics are a very healthy thing for UFOs, and I tend to be somewhat of a skeptic myself. It has always baffled me that some people can be so incredibly narrow-minded when it comes to anything regarding UFOs, because the wealth of evidence out there that proves something has to be going on. Now, instead of examining any of the evidence or testimony of anyone stating that they have seen or encountered a UFO, the debunkers immediately go to work and try to come up with something they can pass off as being what really happened. Now, most of the time, their theories get so shot full of holes, they make Swiss cheese appear solid. It suddenly dawned on me what the problem is. Debunkers, along with most, well, not most, but many other people out there, believe that our species are the most advanced civilization in the universe. Think about it. We have microwaves to do our cooking, robotic vacuum cleaners, personal vehicles that are capable of moving us hundreds of miles in just a few hours, or shared vehicles that can move us thousands of miles in the same time frame. We can communicate with pretty well anyone on the planet. We live 3 to 4 times as long as our ancestors did, and we don't have to spend every waking minute concentrating on finding food or fighting for our very survival. Bottom line, we're on top of the world. But that little illusion gets blown all to hell when somebody shows up that is technologically superior. The debunker realizes that if the UFO stories are real, we're no longer the big guys on the block, because the reports indicate a species that are capable of traversing galaxies the way we move across continents. The aliens or extraterrestrials appear to be impervious to our military efforts to intervene. They move about at speeds that earthly vehicles are not capable of achieving and perform maneuvers that our current scientific knowledge states cannot be achieved because they go against the laws of physics. The reports, if true, indicate that UFOs and their occupants can take members of our tribe anytime they feel like it. The person can be asleep, driving, walking, operating a complex piece of machinery, and they and the rest of us on this planet are absolutely powerless to do anything about it. In fact, if the reports of UFOs and aliens are correct, they are so technologically in advance of our species that it would be similar to comparing our technology to that of the Roman Empire circa 1st century AD. The problem with debunkers is that they are working from a belief system that simply states UFOs do not exist. Ergo, all the reports of anything to do with UFOs are either lies, cases of mistaken identity, or intentional deception. It's a nice little illusionary world they live in because it means that there is nothing out there that is capable of hurting them. If we are the only species capable of intelligent thought in the universe, there is no way we can run into someone who is smarter, faster, or better than we are. But that belief, it falls down flat when we realize that we are not going to be the ones to run into the more advanced civilization. The Aztecs did not cross the ocean and discover the Spaniards. So why would anyone think that we are going to be the ones who cross the vastness of space to discover new planets and civilizations? Those with the superior technology are going to be the ones who discover new worlds, not the other way around. The debunkers had best stop thinking that there is nobody out there that is better than we are, because the tens of thousands of reports about UFOs and their occupants prove otherwise. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlant, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
the immoral debunkers.
Very nicely done, David.
Nicely said, Dave.
Thank you.
Yes.
Nice and clean. I like your... You know what it brings to mind is... David Grinspoon, who I went to see a lecture of his in London, Ontario, several months ago, and he was saying that these ETs, these groups of civilizations, they were experimenting with faster-than-light travel when we were just beginning to walk upright. That's mm-hmm. how far advanced they are. I mean, think about how long that is on the historical perspective. You know, if we're just walking upright and these races are beginning to experiment with faster than the speed of light travel, I mean, how advanced must they be now?
Oh, yeah.
And this is a NASA scientist who's saying this.
That's mm-hmm. right, yes.
Yeah, David Grinspoon was on this program, I guess, about a year ago now.
Right.
Boy, it only seems like a few months, but a year ago, and for he's a young Turk scientist at NASA, and
just
boy,
youngster.
Does he have some disconcerting ideas as far as the old-timers at NASA are concerned.
Well,
publicly concerned, anyway.
Yes. Yeah, well, of course, anytime anybody comes out publicly in contra to NASA, it brings out a lot of raised eyebrows.
Yeah. Well...
It's interesting when you consider it, and like I said, it's going to be the guys who are, you know, technologically superior that are going to discover the other guys. So we best be prepared to be discovered.
If we haven't been discovered already, although the evidence suggests that we were discovered long ago. As David Grinspoon said, they were doing faster than light travel when we were barely learning to walk upright.
Oh, yeah.
And that scares a few people, too.
Oh, it should scare us all a lot.
Well, I mean, if they wanted to do anything really nasty, I think they would have done it already. There's a certain amount of nastiness going on, but it's very much below the surface. Dave Furlant, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We shall talk to you next week.
For sure.
Good night, Dave.
Good night, guys.
How's your paranoia level about listening to us on the radio every Saturday night? Do you think it's possible that somebody has sussed you that you're listening on a Saturday night and might be keeping tabs on you? You buy a UFO magazine in the bookstand, newsstand? You think somebody might be paying attention to what you're buying a UFO book or two at the world's biggest, or perhaps, you know, any of those books, big box bookstores. Our next guest has been doing some interesting research into what causes a paranoia level in some people who work in the ufological field. Nick Redfern's previous books include A Covert Agenda, The FBI Files, Cosmic Crashes, Strange Secrets with Andy Roberts, Three Men Seeking Monsters, and Body Snatchers in the Desert. Nick has written for Military Illustrated, I Spy, Fate, Fortean Times, Phenomena Magazine, and the London Daily Express newspaper. He runs the American office of the British-based Center for Fortean Zoology. Nick says that the government knows all about UFOs, and it knows all about you, too. Let's get into some of this, shall we? Joining us on the phone from his home down there in Tejas, Nick Redfern. Good evening, mate.
Hey, Errol, how's it going? Good to speak to you again.
It's good to talk to you again.
That wasn't a bad accent either.
Yeah, well, it was sort of south of where you're from, but, you know, I haven't been able to do Geordie or Mancunian even.
No, I can't do those.
Yeah, but, you know, I watch Coronation Street religiously, but I can't do it, you know,
yeah.
Other than saying things like gobsmacked.
Gobsmacked, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
But your book has left a few people gobsmacked of late, I understand, huh?
Well, you know, it's one of these areas where I think a lot of people within the UFO subject have either heard stories or had personal involvement where, you know, it kind of seems like at some point they've either been watched or somebody they know has been watched. And, you know, I had experience of this myself and friends and colleagues, and I guess quietly over the last, pretty much over the last 8 or 9 years, but more closely in the last couple of years, I've been digging deeper into the whole issue of official surveillance of the UFO research community, pretty much going back to the 40s right through to literally the present day, and uncovered a lot of material showing that, you know, it isn't just paranoia if you think they're watching you. You know, they actually really are.
Aha. So basically you're saying that agencies that are, you know, associated with the government have their fingers in just about all of the pies of research and public inquiry and all of that. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah, that is what I'm saying. And I think what it comes down to largely is the fact that, you know, if you look at the UFO research community, there's probably, although there's, you know, there's thousands upon thousands of people who are interested in the subject, maybe even millions collectively, but there's probably like a hardcore of, you know, 5,000-6,000 people around the world who do active research and, you know, petition the government agencies to release files. And I think when you have a collective hardcore research community like that, where part of their work involves trying to open up government secrecy and prize government secrets out, then I think it's inevitable that a community of that size is going to be watched, you know, in the same way that any kind of protest group would be. And what I've found is that that is the way in which the government largely perceives the UFO research community to be, like a protest group, if you like, of people knocking on government doors and they're wondering, you know, who are these people? Why are they doing that? And I think that's part of the reason that has led to the surveillance.
Oh, so it's they're not treating UFO people as a bunch of saucer heads who really...
Well, you know, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, you know, when you're looking at a subject which revolves around government secrecy, regardless of whether it's UFOs or it's anything, I think inevitably you're going to attract attention. And I think, you know, the further you dig and the more doors you knock on, that surveillance and interest is going to increase to the point where, you know, files are opened, personnel are sent out to attend conferences even. You know, I found a lot of examples of that. And I think it goes to show that the relevant government agencies not only keep a close watch on people in the subject, but because a lot of us are quite vocal in what we do, it actually becomes quite easy to, you know, follow the trail of who's speaking to who, who's friends with who, and you know, who's saying what and so forth.
And how close they're coming to sensitive documents or materials that might in fact make a difference in the shell game.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, that is one of the key points to remember, is that I think, you know, the idea of being watched is one thing, and I think a lot of the surveillance is done purely and simply at a relatively low level. But I think, you know, if somebody actually got hypothetically too close to like a black box of material, then, you know, who knows to what extent it would be stepped up.
And we don't know whether that black box of material contains stuff about UFOs or something that they're doing at Area 51 or whatever they're testing in the skies over Belgium.
Well, you know, that's one of the interesting things, is that what I found is that one of the concerns that a number of agencies had throughout the years, both in the United States and in England, so presumably, you know, the situation might be very similar in Canada, is that there was this concern that some UFO researchers were using their research as a cover, if you like, to uncover things like details of classified aircraft and defense secrets. And there was actually a fear, almost a paranoia, unjustifiable paranoia, as it turned out, that some UFO researchers actually in the employ of foreign intelligence services to gather domestic defense secrets, but use their UFO research as the cover for doing that. So there's kind of lots of little different strands to this story that explain how and why surveillance was open. And with some people, it was for one reason, and for other people, it was for a completely different reason. But collectively, you know, it shows literally a mountain of people within the subject being watched.
So what triggered your interest in this portion of the field, Nick Redfern?
Well, I guess basically, Errol, what happened was that back in the late 1990s, after one of my books was published, Cosmic Crashes, and covert agenda also. I came into contact with a couple of people from the British government special branch. Special branch is a division of the British police force. And I was researching an incident that occurred in 1974, a UFO incident, which special branch had sort of tangential interest in. And as I began to dig further into this particular story, I made kind of off-the-record contacts with a couple of people who were retired from Special Branch but who'd been in the service in the 1970s and 80s, it became clear to me that Special Branch had actually had involvement in monitoring people within the UFO subject. And taking that lead, I guess, I began to dig deeper into the British side of things and found that everybody from the early 50s onwards, like Desmond Leslie, who co-wrote Flying Saucers Have Landed with George Adamski, even people like George King of the Aetherius Society, had all been watched at various points by Special Branch. And this continued through the 70s and finally found that both myself and several colleagues in England, one being a man named Robin Cole and another guy named Matthew Williams, were also being watched by Special Branch. And this purely and simply related to the fact that we were kind of doing a little bit of unconventional investigations in terms of targeting and focusing on military bases and what was going on there and trying to track down retired military people who worked there and ask them about their opinions on UFO cases. And it was because we were all doing this in the same time period and we were all friends, it was a case of the official world looking and saying, you know, hang on a minute, who are these guys? Why are they, you know, tracking down retired squadron leaders and turning up on the doorsteps of military bases? You know, we were perceived as like anti-establishment types.
And it turned out that you were.
Well, to an extent, yes.
Lo and behold.
Lo and behold.
Since 1947, official agencies across the world, including the CIA, the FBI, the United States Air Force, the National Security Agency, the NSA, and the British Ministry of Defense have undertaken clandestine UFO investigations and have compiled thousands of pages of classified documentation on this strange, unearthly subject. But in their quest for the truth about UFOs, these same agencies have been secretly spying on you and me and Victor and everybody else who's involved in this field as well. It isn't paranoia if you think they are watching you. They really are. That's according to our guest this hour, Nick Redfern, whose new book, On the Trail of the Saucer Spies, hit the bookshelves this past week.
Nick, you've really made a point, and I think it's very, to me, it's extremely incisive, that you're talking about some pretty strange aspects to the type of surveillance that's going on. And I know a lot of people out there who have been associated with the subject for a long time look at things like, you know, Men in Black as being something kind of far out there. But you have a stand on that, and even things like, you know, phone taps and mail interference of researchers. Mm-hmm. You've really gone out on a limb to describe the different types of surveillance that goes on. Talk to us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the Men in Black mystery, the motif, if you like, has been around pretty much as long as the UFO mystery itself has. Mm-hmm. There are even reports from the Maury Island case of 47, which some people think was a hoax, but even in that case, there are reports of Men in Black type people going around intimidating witnesses and so forth.
Rowdy Ruddy Piper.
Yeah.
From X-Files, sorry.
Yeah. But the biggest problem with the Men in Black accounts isn't the fact that the witnesses are credible. A lot of witnesses to MIB encounters are very credible. The problem is in terms of trying to verify or determine who these mystery people are. And I've done a lot of research into this area, particularly back in England, and probably investigated, I would say, probably between 15 and 20 MIB reports that fit the classic image of, like, the guy in the black suit and the black tie, even down to the black car. Now, again, as I said, the problem is in terms of verifying where these people come from. One of the things that I did, I interviewed a lady about 10 years ago now named Anne Lehman, who lives in England, and she'd had a classic encounter where she'd seen this strange thing in the sky. She actually reported it to a local Air Force base, and some guy turned up on the doorstep one night with a black car, classic black suit, black tie, and she invited him in. He showed credentials but didn't identify himself as coming from that particular Air Force base, and basically told her not to talk about this incident and confiscated some compass drawings and notes that she'd made concerning the incident. Now, of course, that has all the classic ingredients of an MIB encounter, even down to the warning about don't talk about this and confiscation of materials. What I did, I found out she could remember pretty much the year and the month even when this occurred, and this was 1962. So I did kind of like a fishing expedition at the British National Archives and checked all the files for the air bases in the vicinity where she lived from that period that had been declassified, and sure enough, I actually found the official file on her case. And sure enough, it showed that a sergeant in one particular division of the Air Force had gone round to her house and compiled about a 10-page report on the encounter. What was more intriguing was that the sergeant, whose name was J.W. Scott, was attached to a division of the British police, sorry, the British RAF, called the Provost and Security Services. Now, these guys are specifically trained in counterintelligence and espionage operations, and they're the British equivalents of the American AFOSI, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. And so what I've been able to prove, and now I've got other documents from other cases, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, even though I'm saying this myself, I'm pretty convinced that I've identified the British MIBs as originating with this branch called the Provost and Security Services, and they're kind of like the James Bonds of the British Air Force, and that leads me to conclude that a lot of these people, whether it's in the US or Canada or England, are attached to similar organizations.
To say you're coming close to the MIB concept is really earth-shattering. I just can't believe that you say that with the confidence that you're saying it. That's quite a coup to say that.
There are some very strange MIB stories out there. Nick, we need to break for the latest from the newsroom, but we shall return with Nick Redfern. If you're online, go take a look at his book. It's available as a link. On the Trail of the Saucer Spies is Nick Redfern's latest. Just go to virtuallystrange.net. Click Strange Days Indeed in tonight's program listing. On the Trail of the Saucer Spies, click that. It will reveal much for you. Yes, it's Saturday night. It's the night of the flying saucers. We do this every Saturday night between 9 and 11, and it's good to have you along, whether you be listening on the Big Stick here in Toronto, whether you're listening in Montreal, or whether you're listening around the world on the web. It's good to have you along. It's good to know that you're out there. A man who is also out there is Nick Redfern. He's had quite a checkered career, a storied career, I believe is the expression. He has himself a new book, On the Trail of the Saucer Spies. If you think you're being watched, you're paranoid. If you think you're paranoid, you're not. You're probably being watched. What was the indicator to you, Nick Redfern, that you were being watched?
Oh, well, basically what happened, Errol, was that, as I mentioned earlier, I was doing some research and tracking down retired people who worked at Special Branch, actually for a completely different subject. This was a book I was going to plan to write on surveillance of rock stars, like people like John Lennon and people like that. And what happened was that the further I dug into this, it became quite clear to me that Special Branch in England, as I said, which is this intelligence division of the British police force, had been involved in basically putting under surveillance countless UFO researchers. And it's very often those where they also had backgrounds with the governments perceived to be like anti-establishment types and things like that. And what I found was that there was a file on me because back in the, going back to the early 80s, I was quite heavily involved in animal rights organizations and things like that. And then when, of course, I also began to get involved in the UFO subject, that was stepped up, if you like. But what was really one of the kickers that kind of confirmed it was that a friend of mine, Robin Cole, who lives in the English city of Cheltenham, was investigating the way in which Britain's GCHQ, which is the British equivalent of the NSA, was involved in the UFO subject. And he uncovered a tremendous amount of material and published a self-published report on this subject. And after it was published, Robin actually received a phone call from Special Branch and said, can we come round? We need to speak to you about your report. Now, I guess in the States, you know, they would have just turned up on the doorstep.
Yeah.
You know, in kind of sleepy old England, they phoned up and said, would you mind if we come round?
They're extremely polite, yes.
Yeah,
they made an appointment, right?
Yeah.
Terrific.
So what happened was that because Robin had like 10 minutes before they arrived, he surreptitiously set up a tape recorder in his living room and taped the entire conversation when they were grilling him.
Mm.
And, I'd listened to that tape. And Robin the Special Branch quite clearly made it obvious to Robin that they were aware of his research and also the research of one of the other people I mentioned, Matthew Williams. And they wanted to know if collectively our research was, or if Robin perceived it to be a cover for working, you know, with subversive groups, which of course it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of the angles they were looking into. But to have this actually on tape was one of the things that really brought it home that this surveillance was going on. And then one of the people I was speaking to about the rock music book kind of confided in me how about the way in which he had been involved in the surveillance of people going back to 74, and then back in the 90s, in the 1990s, he was contracted when he was actually retired from Special Branch, but he got his own security company and did, I guess, off the books work for the intelligence services when they didn't want their hands officially tied to them. And he was part of this ongoing surveillance, which he said encompassed about 20 other people in England, which did revolve around pretty much widespread surveillance of most of the influential and well-known people in the British UFO research community. And on top of that, David Clarke, another British researcher, actually got Special Branch to declassify the files on George King and Desmond Leslie. So we're actually able to verify that they have these files now. So it was kind of just, you know, taking one step and then another step and another and then putting the whole picture together.
So is it your feeling that most of these people were being kept under surveillance because of their UFO work or the potential of them being involved, as you say, with subversive groups?
Well, they were being watched. There was no doubt they were being watched because they were in the UFO subject, but the ones who were being watched, for the most part, as far as I can tell, were the ones where agencies had got it into their heads that, you know, where could these people actually have been recruited to, you know, find out defense secrets and things like that. There was actually another interesting angle with what happened in England, where one UFO group, which was known as the Aerial Phenomena Inquiry Network, or APEN, was established. And this was a very mysterious group, and even to this day, the group has never actually gone public. They used to send letters out and try and recruit people into their ranks. And Special Branch came to the conclusion that because there are a lot of extreme right-wingers tied to this organization, that they're actually using the UFO subject to kind of recruit disaffected younger people to an ultra-right-wing underground organization, but to hide it under cover of a UFO group. And so you had some really weird reasons why people in the UFO subject were being watched. Another classic example is a guy in Wales named Matthew Bevan, who hit the newsstands, or the news, about 8 years ago. When he was about 17 or 18, which would be about 1994, he hacked into Wright-Patterson Air Force Base looking for information on Roswell. And he was tracked by Scotland Yard and by the American Air Force Office of Special Investigations and the Air Force Information Warfare Center. And he was subsequently arrested by Scotland Yard's Computer Crime Unit and charged with hacking into various computer systems like Lockheed, NASA, and Wright-Patterson. Now, as I said, he was just a 17-year-old kid at the time looking for information on Roswell. But again, the intelligence world suspected or feared that he'd been recruited by some foreign nation, and again, he was going to, if he was arrested, he would say, well, I was just looking for UFO materials. But he was actually charged, but the case was dropped because American intelligence said that he'd gone into their systems and downloaded materials and had actually changed some of the computer programs. But when the judge said, well, show us evidence, we can't prosecute this guy unless you show us the evidence, of course, the case collapsed because American intelligence wouldn't share with the judge or the jury what was on the computers.
Mm.
So, you know, it was kind of like not presenting a body in a murder case. But one of the things that Matthew actually did find, and he was questioned quite vigorously by Scotland Yard, and this is a matter of official record, this isn't like a classified secret, I'm telling you, this is part of the official record. He said that when he got into the Wright-Patterson computers, although he didn't find anything on crashed UFOs, what he did find was a whole bunch of research which may have actually gone past the theoretical stage into what, in simplistic terms, we would call anti-gravity research. And this is actually entered into the interview that Matthew Bevan undertook with Scotland Yard when he was arrested. This is one of the things that Scotland Yard brought up. So, again, as I said, that's something which can be proven at an official level.
Nick Redfern is our guest. His newest book, On the Trail of the Saucer Spies, it's one that you should definitely go out and get, especially if you're paranoid that they are watching you. It will not alleviate your fears any at all. As we've said many times on this program, we're amazed that we're still here doing what we're doing after 8 years.
And who's listening to us?
Well, yeah, and the number of phone calls that you and I make that are related to this field every week.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be interesting to see the phone logs of theirs about what it is that we talk about.
I'd roll the dice in that favor for sure.
Nick Redfern is with us. Nick, your last book, Body Snatchers in the Desert, raised, just to put it mildly, a bit of a ruck.
No.
Yeah.
As you will know from UFO updates.
Yeah, there's it still continues to this day. I don't want to spend too much time going into what Body Snatchers in the Desert is all about. It's an alternative scenario for what actually happened in the Roswell area in 1947 and around White Sands Proving Grounds. Any new information in that area since the book was published?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's one of these things where, you know, I certainly didn't set out to say to everybody, you know, you've got it all wrong about Roswell. What I did, and which I hope I did, was to point out to people, this is what I was told, this is the information, what can we do with it? And what does it tell us? And basically, the story was that the Roswell incident, as I was told by about four or five very elderly retired military and intelligence people, was that it revolved around various human experimentation to do with high-altitude balloon exposure tests and things like that. Since publication of the book, actually quite a few people have come forward, again, retired intelligence and military people, some sons and daughters of people whose parents, if you like, had been in the military and told them similar stories. Now, there are two possibilities. Either it's some sort of weird ongoing disinformation campaign, or elderly people and their children and offspring and so on are, for, because it's genuine, relating the facts as they see them. Now, I think the one thing that we could all agree on with Roswell is that it's that long ago and pretty much everybody's dead. A lot of the stories we're getting are from people who have read files and, you know, were told this and told that.
Hmm.
The one thing I could say about the people that I interviewed personally was that all of them had credentials showing that who they were. Now, as I've pointed out to people, having to know them, if you like, and, you know, things like body language, the more subtle things, I came to the conclusion, and again, based on a lot of the leads they gave me, that they were genuine. If they're not, then somebody is going to extraordinary lengths of literally providing men and women in their 80s with fake credit cards, fake driving licenses, and faked work documents and tax documents, tax returns from years ago, which suggests, you know, an elaborate scheme if it isn't true. You know, I think the problem is where at times, you know, I was almost presented as the worst thing next to Saddam Hussein, was that
<It's just laughs>
literally almost at times.
It's a French opinion. Don't worry about it.
But I think, you know, the problem is when you're dealing with sacred cows like Roswell, that people don't want you, you know, changing your opinion. It's almost like there's this 11th commandment, thou shalt not change thy opinion, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that all of us need to look at cases on their own merit. You know, the important thing is, and I think a lot of people are guilty of not realizing this, the UFO subject, the genuinely weird angle, doesn't stand or fall on Roswell. That's just one case out of tens of thousands,
mm-hmm.
a lot of high-quality ones. You know, and the further I dug into this and found that there were high altitude exposure experiments going on in New Mexico in 1947, I found a lot of weird information about how, for example, the human radiation experiment files, when they surfaced in the 1990s, about how, and this sounds extreme, but it's actually in the declassified files, how the department called the Nuclear Energy for Propulsion of Aircraft were actually lobbying the government to try and get permission to use American prisoners in nuclear aircraft test scenarios. Now, that kind of sounds extreme, you know, but that is in the official files, actually lobbying to try and get permission to use prisoners in these tests. So there was a lot of weird stuff going on from the mid-40s onwards, when legislation wasn't really that strict, despite the Nuremberg scenarios, using people in radiation experiments and things like that. And, you know, when you look at the area, you know, on the one hand, people say, well, if aliens crashed at Roswell, they would come to New Mexico because Los Alamos was there and the White Sands Missile Range, you know, the perfect place to monitor what we were doing. But equally, you know, the argument that I made was that a lot of weird experiments were being undertaken by the military there as well. And, you know, I think being given strands of this story by different people over the course of pretty much a decade, and other people coming forward, one person surfaced from Australia in November on the Project 1947 discussion list, and I interviewed this guy extensively personally in November, I mean personally by phone, not by flight to Australia, and he related a practically identical account given to him by his father years ago, decades ago, about weird high-altitude experiments in the New Mexico desert that failed and that were covered up and so forth. Now, you know, again, I'll be the first to admit, it's how do we prove any of these theories? You know, ironically, even the government with the Project Mogul balloon scenario couldn't find a single document to actually prove that a Mogul balloon or crash test dummies crashed at Roswell. You know, they didn't find any, they thought that was their best guesstimate, if you like, but couldn't find the documents. And I think that is the problem with Roswell, is that, you know, whichever theory ultimately is proven to be correct, if it's ever proven, that is the problem. How do we prove it? You know, the files are gone. The outgoing messages from Roswell were missing. And it does become a case of, no, I'm right, you're wrong, or no, you're wrong, I'm right. And I think that, unfortunately, even though I say it myself, is kind of where we're at right now.
And that's where we're at right now, Nick Redfern, because we just plumb ran out of time.
Oh, well.
Two good books to go out and grab for yourselves. The most recent, On the Trail of the Saucer Spies, and Body Snatchers in the Desert, The Terrible Truth About Roswell. Nick Redfern is the author. Nick, thank you, sir.
All right, Errol. Always happy to come on the show. Enjoy
it's
it.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show. And I'm glad you have warmer weather down there than we have up here.
You know, actually, we're in the middle of a thunderstorm right now. I was hoping the phone lines weren't going to go out or the electric go off. But,
oh, I thought you were trying to bury the cat.
That's tomorrow.
Yeah. Good night, Nick Redfern. Thank you.
Thanks, Errol.
Night-night. Ah, there. An interesting, huh?
Fine researcher.
Yes, he is. And I'm sure many more epics to come out of Nick Redfern. He's still a young guy.
I hope he continues his methodical way of looking at material, because you listen to him talk and you can hear the method in his voice. And I'd like to hear someone who knows their stuff in that kind of way.
And he does. He
certainly does.
And he does. And you read his books and you realize that he really does know his stuff. Victor Vigiani is in studio with me tonight. It's good to have you all along. You missed Nick Redfern, but that file should be up at some point this next couple of days at virtuallystrange.net, and you can hear it in its entirety there. It's an MP3. You can download it and shove it in your pod. Or in your friend's pod. It's entirely up to you. I don't know where I'm going with that, and I better not go any further, had I.
You're on your own.
Yes, that's the problem with being in this chair, in this seat. You're on your own, kid. Another man who largely feels that he's on his own down there in Alabama, and we talked you up a little bit at the beginning of the program. Good evening, Alfred Lemberg.
And good evening, Errol. Good evening, Victor.
Good evening.
I was waiting for the whistle. It didn't happen.
That comes at some times, or it doesn't.
Ah.
You know, it's one of those, well...
crescendo kind of things,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, okay. Or not.
Yeah. were you listening online earlier?
Oh, yes. I'm anticipating Victor's curveballs. But toss them!
Oh.
Throw them at me! I accept all challenges. Yes.
Yes, what a former military man you are.
Yes, yes. Critical point. That's what I'm all about. Task, organization, it's all there.
Yes. And that's it. Thanks, Alfred.
Well, listen, before the evening goes on too much farther, maybe I should tell everybody about my latest UFO sighting.
Oh, you have another UFO sighting to report?
And actually, I kept meaning to talk about it with you when we talked on the phone today, Errol, and we were just talking about other things.
Well, we were. Much more interesting things, apparently.
And then we got down to there to the end where you remember it was very critical that I get off the phone, like,
yeah.
Right now.
Because you weren't on a cordless phone, yes.
Yeah, so you could listen, you know.
Yeah.
You know, anything for the sound effects gallery.
Mm-hmm. So let's hear about it. Go ahead.
At any rate, I woke up early this morning, about 1:30, went outside, and, you know, with my usual cup of liquid ambition, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just looking to the south, and I'm looking at these two stars that I'm familiar with, that they look like they're right together about an inch apart as you look at them, you know.
Mm.
And but actually one is like 5 times the distance, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm marveling at the distance, you know, thinking about space, time, and you know, the universe. And
life, the universe, and everything, yeah.
And all the, you know, and my towel, and, you know.
And do I have my babelfish stuck in my ear? Yes.
Exactly. You know, making sure it's all there, all present duty and accounted for. At any rate, I'm looking to the south, and I'm looking at these stars that are there in the firmament. And I get one of what I call blinkers. You know, I've seen these before. They blink at regular or irregular times. You know, just a point source light blinking. At any rate, this thing is, as it turns out, blinks very regularly. As near as I could figure, every 9 seconds. And it's making this little, you know, with these two stars that I'm looking at, it's making this equilateral triangle, you know. All the angles in this triangle are equal, this thing's making. I'm watching it and thinking, it's a satellite. And then, lo and behold, did that equilateral triangle start to get very squashed, and the apex of that triangle started getting very close to the base. By the way, all this is going due east, the most east of due east. Then the blinking light starts to swing out more to the west from the east, you know, starts traveling west, still blinking at 9. And I watched it for a period of, I must have watched it for 15 minutes doing this. And, you know, like I say, point source light, not acting like an airplane or a bird or a bolide or a rocket booster, up there in the sky doing the strange things. And I saw it, and I'm reporting it to you as we speak. If I'm lying, I'm dying.
Not only is he a regular contributor to this program every couple of weeks, but he's also one of our leading UFO witnesses down there in Alabama.
And I'll tell anybody who's listening can go out and let's face it, you gotta spend some you know, heavy lifting time out there and watch for an extended period of time. But if you have any time at all to do it, look at the sky. There's a very good chance you'll be astonished at what you're seeing.
Even just satellites flying across in little triangular groups. That's an interesting flying from south to north, which they don't normally do.
Seriously. And, you know, with regards to satellites, I'm not, you know, I've got prediction programs that look at them. You know, I have two now that I think I can depend on that tell me what's supposed to be up there and when it's supposed to be up there. And anything that I take trouble to report to you, I have drawn through that sieve. Okay. So, you know, we don't have to even be thinking about satellites. I'm talking about non-prosaic stuff that, I mean, everybody in the universe, and Mr. Red Fern has seemed to confirm it, knows is up there.
Mm. Yes, and he certainly seems to confirm it on an ongoing basis. You drew an interesting parallel between Nick Redfern and a man who was up here at the Disclosure Conference back in September of last year.
Oh, so much maligned Richard Dolan.
Mm-hmm.
That's
to whom I'm referring at this moment.
I was going to say that Richard Dolan, you know, went a long way through hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of citations, pretty much verifying, I haven't read Mr. Redfern's book yet, but pretty much verifying everything he seemed to be talking about with regard to UFOs and the national security state.
Mm-hmm.
And the complicity of a plethora of different lettered agencies, right on down. I'm sure there's one for M&Ms, you know. complete and absolute craziness of letters that, I think you guys up there would have to agree that the United States has been acting a little twitchy south of the border here of late.
I don't know how
you guys feel about that, but we're certainly noticing it down here.
Well, yes, I would imagine you've been noticing it for the last 6 years.
Oh, you think?
No, it can't be. Folks in the United States that sensitive?
Getting back to Richard Dolan, just to clean him up really quickly.
Yes.
It seems to me that those two books that Mr. Redfern's and Mr. Dolan's, those two books could be taken as a companion set, and they're getting a wide triangulation of the same thing, you know, wide triangulation of view on the same thing could be very edifying to many people, and just the sort of thing that needs to be talked about in this day and age with regard to what we were alluding to earlier.
Yes. Alfred Lemberg is a regular contributor to this program. Alienview.net is his website. You should go check that out.
Go to sleep. Everything is fine.
Hark. I hear voices.
Okay, you two. That's enough.
I thought you would have appreciated that, baby.
It was well done. It rounded the whole thing out. Thank you.
We spent quite a bit of time, Alfred, talking about surveillance and things with Nick Redfern last hour. And I wanted to get your understanding of surveillance. The way I look at it is that the people who are listening and watching and recording and doing all that thing, they're the ones that are sort of listening to what we're talking about. And as soon as we talk about something that we shouldn't talk about, that's when they really kick into action. How do you think they can tell about what we should talk about and what we are just talking about as a normal course of action?
Well, I don't think they're worried about that so much as just maintaining the status quo of what is supporting them and providing them the most black books in the file analysis. Because, you know, we're looking at this thing, and it's kind of obvious based on what Richard Dolan has written, based on apparently now what Nick Redfern has written, that if we presume that it's obvious, okay, that the interested, you know, those of us who are interested in UFOs and what have you,
mm-hmm.
are being surveilled in that manner that you allude to, you know, the question is literally begged, why the interest? You know, why are they interested? Why do a bunch of crazy UFO wackos who, you know, like haven't gotten anywhere in 60-odd years, I might add, why are they remotely interested in what we would have to say on this subject? I'm perplexed by that.
I would take it that they're just waiting for us to find out the kernel of evidence that's going to tip the scales the other way and whether or not we're getting close to it. And when you do get close to it, or when you do have someone who has information that may be leading you to get close to it, that's when their ears really perk up and they begin to listen and attenuate to the situation a little bit more specifically. Now, what action they take, that's all in conjecture. But I think they're definitely listening for that one kernel or the several strains of information that needs to be sort of exposed to tip the balance. I think that's what they're looking for.
And so the more flack you're getting, the closer to being over the target you are, huh?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, you're just getting all those numbers of different ears listening to you, and the alphabet soup organizations are there, and the more that you get hot, the more the alphabet listens, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And that kind of dovetails a little bit into what Mr. Frelat was talking tonight, you know, his occupation as a people observer when he decided he was going to take the debunkers apart this evening, you know. I love that. And it's we must remind everybody that he is in no way alone with his attitude on these people who wear the unjust mantle of skepticism, that people like Dave Jacobs and Bud Hopkins and Stanton Friedman and Bruce Maccabee and Dr. Sturrock, Dr. Haynes, I mean, I could go on and on with a list of high-quality, undenied, vetted thinkers on the subject of these things, and they all have their little syllogisms about what debunkers do. And still, debunkers are getting more than half of the airtime. They're getting more than half of the credit, more than half of the respect. What's up with that?
I kind of hoped you'd tell me.
Well, I have the answer, but
you did.
You know, but
we can hear the music.
We can't hardly
go
into it on the radio because then the interest is peaked in the individuals we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. Now, are you? Yes. Are you going to put that up on your blog or your website?
What in particular?
Well, the answer.
So
life, the universe, and everything.
See, here's the secret. Here's the secret to Alfred Lindbergh and the alien view thing.
Hmm.
That answer is written in like 380 apologies, 200 alien views, over 100 explications of on UFOs and their strange ancillaries. I've written the answer now for years, guys, I say unabashedly.
Yes, you have. But I still encourage people to go look at your website, alienview.net. And we shall talk to you in a couple of weeks, Alfred Lindbergh.
I'm looking forward to it as always, Oral.
And we do too. And thank you, sir. Ooh, two-toning he is now with his Alabama fog whistle.
I'm branching out.
You are too. You're becoming more and more talented. Not only does he fly helicopters, but he can two-tone Alabama fog whistles.
Come here, Billy Bob. Look at this.
Golly, good night, Alfred.
Good night.
Jim Pacheco in Montreal, Drew Garner here in Toronto, Julian, thank you all, Victor Vigiani, Dave Frelat, and Nick Redfern. Good night, Victor.
As always, thank you.
We'll see you next week.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Dean Mascardelli.